The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
We must moderate our language, and it has to come from the Prime Minister first.
I have to say, Mr. Speaker, I've never heard such humbug in all my life.
Parliamentarians found themselves unexpectedly back at work yesterday after the Supreme Court unanimously ruled Boris Johnson's prorogation of Parliament to be unlawful. If they were expecting an apology, they were mistaken. Johnson told them that while he had the highest respect for our judiciary, they were wrong, and dismissed MPs' fears that his use of inflammatory language was dangerous as humbug. Meanwhile, his BFF Donald Trump found himself facing impeachment after he allegedly asked the Ukrainian president to snoop on a political rival. The Democrats are delighted, but could this episode ultimately play in Trump's favour? Also this week, loyalty to Jeremy Corbyn trumped loathing of Brexit at this week's Labour Party conference in Brighton. And activists were told to get ready to fight and win a general election. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, the Supreme Court ruled this week that Boris Johnson's advice to the Queen that Parliament should be prorogued for 5 weeks was unlawful. Responding to the judgment, the Commons Speaker John Bercow said the House should convene without delay, and opposition leaders clamoured for Johnson to resign. The PM was having none of it. Racing back to the UK from the UN General Assembly in New York, he told MPs he'd done nothing wrong. And in a rowdy and ill-tempered debate in the House of Commons last night, he even said the best way to honour murdered Labour MP Joe Cox's memory was to get Brexit done. Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Sonia Soda from The Observer, Ellie Mae O'Hagan from The Guardian, and Theresa May's former press secretary, Paul Harrison. Hello all. Sonia, it was pretty toxic stuff last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really shocking to watch, actually. I mean, I think we all feel that sort of political discourse has really sort of gone downhill quite a lot in recent weeks and months. But for me, last night was a totally new low. And it wasn't just the sort of lack of humility, the lack of apology from Boris Johnson about the fact that he, you know, his actions have been unlawful. He's been found to have misled the Queen. But it was also just the sort of shamefulness of his response to a long line of female MPs who was standing up, pleading with him to moderate his language. He was using language like surrender bill to refer to the Benn Act. And, you know, an MP like Paula Sheriff was actually saying, some of that language that you're using, it's getting echoed back to me in death threats that I'm receiving. So talking about really, really distressing stuff. And you just have Boris Johnson stand up and say, that's a load of humbug. And, you know, he actually said, and for me, this was just... I found it unbelievably shocking that he crossed the line of saying, well, the best way of, you know, Joe Cox's, the assassinated MP's friends were talking about her in the Commons. And, you know, he actually said, you know, the best way to honour Joe Cox's memory is to deliver Brexit, which is just such an unbelievably crass thing to say. So I think there was, there was genuine shock in the Commons last night, whether it's from MPs and from journalists who are watching the debate, from people reacting on social media at where Boris Johnson took it. It felt like he was sort of plumbing new depths.
Paul, we've seen that kind of language about surrender and betrayal and whatever on, you know, on the front pages of the papers, yep, in the right-wing papers for quite a long time, and you hear it a lot from a particular kind of Tory MP, the Marc Francois of this world, the Andrew Bridgens. We wouldn't have heard it from Theresa May, would we?
I think, yeah, I mean, Theresa is a different person to our current Prime Minister. Every Prime Minister is different, and people choose their words differently. I think ultimately it was last night, kind of the unexpected recall of Parliament. You know, it was sadly just... The session itself was a pretty unedifying prospect all round. And, you know, I agree with Sonia that there has been, over the last several years, probably a coarsening of our public debate on all sides. I think, you know, there's responsibility that has to be borne by people on all sides of the debate. It was pretty sad to see. But, you know, we just somehow... need to, and you know, it's not the most inspiring rallying cry, but just somehow unite around a compromise that sees, you know, a solution presented to this problem that's becoming like an existential problem in terms of our politics.
How do we get out of it, Sonia? How do we stop shouting at each other across the barricades?
Well, there's a sort of big question about how we might sort of dial down the sort of negativity in our political discourse. And that's really difficult. It's really, you know, when you see Boris Johnson say some of the things that he was saying last night, it's very hard to unsay those things. And it feels that that coarsening of the discourse, it can be reversed potentially, but over a very long period. Then I think there's a sort of shorter term question, which is what's the way out of this political gridlock which we find ourselves in? And I mean, it feels to me like they're just, you know, there has to be a general election. That's kind of the only way out, given that there's no majority in Parliament for anything. I completely understand why the opposition parties are not going for a general election yet. They don't want to play into Boris Johnson's hand. They don't want to give him the opportunity to rather sneakily crash the UK out of Europe without a deal on the 31st of October, because Parliament isn't sitting and he chooses to sort of break the law, the Benn Act that's been passed. So you can totally see their logic. You know, there's obviously some political calculations going on there as well. It's not just about preventing a no-deal Brexit. But I think we will see a general election happen very quickly and get it called in, maybe in the second half of October. There is some talk in Parliament. It was interesting, before last night, there was some talk about whether some compromise might be able to be reached. A few months ago, Peter Kyle, the Labour MP, was quite instrumental in trying to forge a compromise with Theresa May, whereby the withdrawal agreement would be passed and MPs would vote for it in exchange for it being put to a confirmatory referendum. I thought it was interesting that yesterday afternoon there was some talk in Parliament of that again. Peter Kyle was again floating that idea. If Boris Johnson gets a deal, could we do this as some sort of compromise? I was on a panel with Stephen Kinnock at Labour Party conference earlier this week. You know, he wants to see us leave with a deal, but he said that was a compromise he could live with. Ken Clark said that on the radio this week. So that was quite interesting. I think it was always hard to see that coming off, though, just because it would take such unity to sort of see a referendum through amongst people who think very differently about this. But I have to say, after last night, it feels like there's just no chance of that happening at all.
Do you think does that feel right, Paul? We've sort of been here before.
We have. I mean, there's a practical consequence, I suppose. I do think that the coarsening of debate isn't the responsibility of any one person or any one side of this argument. I think it is important to say that. But practically, there is very little chance, I don't think, of Boris being able to get all the votes on his side, and he doesn't have a majority anyway. And therefore, he's going to need, in order to pass a deal, which, you know, God knows, Theresa said...
You did try that.
Until she was blue in the face. And I think it's true. It is the best way out of this. You know, he's going to struggle with Labour votes even more than he might have done otherwise. And
I don't think Labour, you know, I think it's very hard after last night for Labour MPs to back Boris Johnson on a deal. And I think, to me, it says that he's not interested in that compromise strategy. It says that he's going all out for no deal.
Look, maybe not, although I think the constituents of all MPs everywhere, I still think that backing a deal is the least worst option. So there is a question about whether an appeal to kind of, you know, a sort of a higher state of consciousness, whatever you want to call it, it's less divisive than a second referendum. It's certainly less messy than a general election. It's better economically than no deal. It keeps the country together. You don't have the Northern Ireland problem. So it remains the best option. It just, I hope it hasn't become more elusive as a result of recent events.
Ellie May, it does make you wonder, doesn't it, about the idea of a referendum, that could kind of heal things, that it could sort of draw a line under this very toxic debate. I mean, it would be a pretty brutal campaign again, wouldn't it?
Well, I've always been opposed to a second referendum for exactly that reason. And I've always been opposed to a second referendum because I don't think that even now that the Remain campaign has made a compelling case for staying in the EU. So I worry that the Leave vote would triumph again. However, the reason why I have pushed the Labour Party to adopt it as their position, nevertheless, and the reason why I also think that the Labour Party should be campaigning for Remain rather than staying neutral, is because the people that vote Labour, that's what they want. And I also think that there is a big group of very radicalised Remainers who won't accept any form of Brexit, even the softest one possible. And there's a big group of very hardened Leavers who only want no deal. And then there's a whole chunk of people in the middle who are very distressed and very confused by the constant chaos of politics. And so for me, the other reason why I think a second referendum with clear outcomes would be good is because it would help alleviate that sense of panic and confusion, which I think a lot of people are feeling right now, and they're not really being spoken to, because the only people that I think are being spoken to at the moment are the sort of hardest leavers and the hardest
on one side or the other.
Yeah, and the thing I would say, I think the reason why I disagree with you on the deal sort of being the best way forward is that it's only a withdrawal agreement. It doesn't set out the future relationship with the EU. I think this is a really big problem democratically for a second referendum. By the way, I think ideally you'd have a second referendum that puts, you know, an off-the-shelf form of Brexit on the table for people to vote for versus Remain. But the problem with just putting the withdrawal agreement to a referendum is it's just the exit terms. And so it's not really going to resolve anything, because I still don't think there's a majority in the country for any one particular type of Brexit. So, I would prefer a deal to no deal, obviously, but whether you no deal, we're going to be talking about this for years to come. Whether you exit with a deal, we absolutely will be. I think if we have a referendum and Remain wins, and a referendum is the option I would like to see resolve this, we're still going to be talking about this for years to come. It's you know, the Observer's long been in favour of a second referendum. But yeah. There's no way that this will not define our politics, I think. So it would be naive to think you have a referendum and it goes away. It's just that it's very hard to see another practical way out of this impasse.
We should just talk about one more issue that's in Boris Johnson's in tray this week before we move on to Labour. He's under increasing pressure, isn't he, to explain his friendship with the tech entrepreneur Jennifer Arcuri, who seems to have received £100,000 of government grants. This is during his period as Mayor of London. And yesterday it emerged that her UK-based firm that pocketed this taxpayers' money was actually based in the US. Could this lead anywhere, Sonia, or are these sorts of things just priced in for Johnson?
I mean, unfortunately, I think there is an extent to which it's priced in. I think under normal circumstances, for any sort of prime minister facing these sorts of questions about his probity, about financial dealings, and, you know, the use of taxpayers' money and whether or not it's getting paid essentially to your mates, they would be huge. 20 years ago, this would have been a massive story, potentially a resigning matter for a prime minister. Sadly, we just don't live in that world anymore. And I think, I think there is probably more stuff to come. I think there's a small chance it might stick to Johnson, but I'm a little bit pessimistic that it will, actually. And I think, if anything, you know, Boris Johnson's performance in the Commons last night and will serve to attract attention away from some of these questions about Arcuri. So, it's a bit depressing, but I'm not at all sure that it will. I think it's very important that papers like ours continue to report on it, and we continue to try and expose the truth about Johnson and some of these dealings. But I'm less optimistic that it's going to stick.
Paul, did you feel for your successor when you saw that story drop in the Sunday Times?
I didn't really know quite what to make of it, to be honest. I'm a bit of a technophobe, but I've not had a technology lesson like that. I think ultimately, you know, the media have to do what they do, and they will investigate it. And if there is, and it will have to be accounted for if it turns out that that something improper has happened. To be honest, I don't know whether that's the case or not.
I don't think any of us do yet, do we?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, we'll have to leave that there.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together, we can fight for a better one.
Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Welcome back. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law, said Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Tuesday, announcing that the US House of Representatives would begin a formal impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump. At the heart of it are allegations that Trump pressured the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to dig up dirt to use against his political opponent, Joe Biden. It was the moment Democrats had been waiting for. Trump went on the offensive immediately, tweeting about a total witch hunt scam by the Democrats and claiming presidential harassment. The 5-page rough transcript of the conversation was released yesterday. Democrats claimed it was a devastating betrayal of their country, and Republicans claimed it showed no quid pro quo and vindicated the president. Well, they can't both be right. To explain it all on the phone, we have Guardian Washington Bureau Chief David Smith. So how did this come to light, David?
It came to light from a whistleblower's complaint. A whistleblower in the US intelligence community really felt alarmed about Donald Trump's phone conversation on the 25th of July with Ukrainian President Zelensky, and so lodged that complaint with the Inspector General, saying that it had all the appearance of Trump putting his own personal political gain ahead of American national security. And what the whistleblower was referring to was Trump's conversation where he asked the Ukrainian president to investigate one of Trump's own political rivals, namely Joe Biden, the former U.S. vice president and one of the front runners for the nomination for 2020 to run against Trump. Specifically, Trump was trying to raise questions about Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who was on the board of a gas company in Ukraine. And that company was being investigated by a prosecutor who was then removed under some pressure from Joe Biden, but indeed from many other governments and watchdogs too. There is absolutely no evidence of any wrongdoing by Joe Biden or his son, but nevertheless, that's what Trump is trying to raise questions about.
And how serious could this be for Trump?
It could be extremely serious now. I think impeachment is more likely than it has been at any point so far in the Trump presidency, despite all the scandals, all the dramas, and of course the whole special counsel Robert Mueller investigation into alleged collusion with Russia. This case seems to be more clear-cut and immediate and involve Trump himself personally. And very importantly, unlike the Russia collusion allegations, this is something that happened when Trump was actually in office, in the presidency, able to use the levers of power. So this week, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, declared the House would launch an impeachment inquiry. It's only happened a handful of times before in American history, most recently Bill Clinton, of course, in the 1990s. Whatever happens, it would be an asterisk against Trump's name. It would be a constant blot on his presidency. But it's not so serious that I think he's likely to be removed from office, bearing in mind even if the House impeaches him, it then goes to the Senate, who would have to convict him, and that's highly unlikely, given that it's controlled by his Republican Party.
And will Trump's loyal base of voters be bothered by any of this, or will it actually play into his hands?
The early signs are that Trump's hardcore support is not bothered by this. And almost as soon as the impeachment inquiry was announced, you saw rather predictably a massive counteroffensive launched by all in the Trump cosmos. That includes Trump's own Twitter account. It includes his son, Donald Trump Jr., who's become a very aggressive surrogate on his behalf. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who was on cable news, literally shouting at people, telling them to shut up and get off the airwaves. And indeed, Fox News, the conservative channel, has been almost entirely on Trump's side with this. And so too, very importantly, the majority of Republicans who are dismissing it as a witch hunt or the hoax, and again, comparing it to the Mueller investigation, which they argue was built on sand. The Trump campaign has actively said they hope to turn it to his advantage, that the trying to show that Democrats don't want to work on politics merely to impeach the president because they can't beat him at the ballot box. And they've even been raising funds off it. They've been firing off several emails talking about seeking donations for the Defense Impeachment Task Force or something like that. So, yeah, there is certainly a fear among some that it could backfire and actually be used as a recruiting tool by Trump's allies.
So what happens next?
Well, as we speak, there's very important hearings happening on Capitol Hill with the acting director of National Intelligence. And in the last few hours, we've had the release of the whistleblower's report, which underlines many of the concerns about that phone conversation with the president of Ukraine, but also shows how the White House tried to conceal the contents of that conversation for some time. So I think the bitter polarization will just deepen. Democrats are saying it's a betrayal of the country that deserves impeachment, and Republicans are saying nothing to see here. The president is totally vindicated. I would expect the temperature to continue to rise, but probably we will not see impeachment happen instantly. It's an inquiry. There are various committees involved. It could be quite a protracted, drawn-out process. The only thing we can safely predict is that even less than usual will get done in Washington, and legislation that will be on hold while this psychodrama, this melodrama plays out.
David Smith there. Now, the Supreme Court verdict electrified Labour Party conference on Tuesday, with Jeremy Corbyn bringing his closing speech forward and MPs hot-footing it back to Westminster for the reopening of Parliament. The distraction was a considerable relief after conference kicked off with a botched bid to abolish Tom Watson's job and continued with attempts to force the Labour leadership to adopt an out-and-out Remain position before a general election. The motion, Composite 13 to those in the know, was rejected. The party faithful started singing "Oh Jeremy Corbyn," and for a brief moment it was 2017 all over again. Not everyone was thrilled, though. After the vote, I caught up with Labour's Keir Starmer. So I'm here in a very sort of buzzy coffee room with Keir Starmer, where earlier there was a huge crowd watching the Supreme Court judgment. All this has made us forget almost completely about yesterday's issue here at conference, which of course was Brexit. You were in that late night compositing meeting that came up with two statements, one of which was one that would see Labour adopt a Remain position now up front before a general election. That statement wasn't passed on the conference floor yesterday. Are you happy now with where we've ended up?
I'm disappointed with where we've ended up because I've said many times that we should campaign to Remain. But I don't want to lose sight of what we have achieved, which is significant, because we've moved from a position where a year ago we were saying that nobody is ruling out the option of Remain in a possible public vote, to a very firm commitment by the Labour Party that whether it's in this government, this Parliament, or the next, there is going to have to be a referendum, and that Remain must be an option on the ballot paper. So in terms of the sort of substance of the thing, we have moved a long way, and in all the sort of fallout of yesterday, we mustn't lose sight of that.
And do you feel confident that you can go out and campaign in a general election, which could come within months, within weeks, on the basis of this position?
I do, for this reason. The Tories, on the one hand, are saying we will go for a no-deal Brexit without consulting the country. The Lib Dems are saying we'll revoke without consulting the country. What Labour is saying is the only way to break the deadlock is to ask the public. We'll do it through a referendum. So that space in the middle to say there is a way out and it involves a referendum and the public is Labour's position. And in my experience, going across the country, people are yearning for this deadlock to be broken. And even people who were against a referendum, you know, 6 months, a year ago, are now saying, if that's the way to break the deadlock, then I'm prepared to go down that road. And that, lots of Labour MPs have got into that space, lots of Labour members and members of the public. In other words, there's a sense that, notwithstanding the obvious difficulties of a further referendum, if it breaks the deadlock, then it's the right thing to do. So I do think that is a position which will have traction when we have a general election.
Keir Starmer, thank you very much. Keir Starmer there. Brexit aside, the rows overshadowed a string of big pre-election policy announcements, a four-day week, getting rid of private schools among them. Let's look at some of them. Ellie, this was a really kind of radical conference. It wasn't necessarily what the headlines were about, which was often Brexit, but so scrapping private schools, a four-day week, really radical migration policy that got passed yesterday. Yeah. Is this a great sort of flowering of all these left-wing members that Jeremy Corbyn has invited in, or is it a sort of electoral suicide note?
Well, let's hope not, because you haven't mentioned my favourite policy, which is the Green New Deal.
Oh,
which is the the conference passed a motion to meet a net zero emissions target by 2030. which is hugely important and I think makes the case for voting Labour absolutely inarguable given the climate science. Yeah, I think that was single-handedly actually the most important thing that has happened in Britain this week, even more so than Boris Johnson, given the what might happen if we don't take extremely radical measures to tackle climate change. You know, the IPCC is now saying that the best case scenario is a significant sea level rise by 2100, which will displace thousands of people in this country. It's the best case if we do everything now. So yes, I thought in terms of policy, I think it's the best Labour conference I've ever been to, and I wasted my youth and went to 8 of them. So in terms of that, I thought it was great.
How will Paul, Conservatives respond to some of these policies? I mean, the Labour front bench, in fact, was somewhat wary of some of them. So the private schools things, for example. Yeah. I mean, are some of these things a gift to the Tories or are they actually retail policies?
I guess some people will have noticed scrapping Tom Watson and scrapping Eaton, which aren't necessarily the headlines that, as Ellie May says, actually you would have wanted to come out of there. Just for regular listeners of this podcast, I should plug the government's existing net zero commitment.
It's not good enough.
Well, hang on a second, because it was actually, arrived at by some people who know what they're talking about. An independent committee on climate change said that is, all other things being equal, 2050, which is the government's legal commitment, is the best thing to do, because obviously it would involve pretty dramatic lifestyle changes in terms of flying and eating meat if you do it sooner than that. So there are trade-offs here, and
it's not good enough in the lifestyle changes that you have to make as a result of catastrophic climate change are much more serious than anything that's being suggested by a 2030 net zero emissions target. And also in terms of what the government is doing on climate change, the government is saying one thing and pursuing policies that mean that even that 2050 target is impossible. So I don't think there's any leg to stand on to suggest that the government is anywhere near good enough on this.
I mean, look, I knew I shouldn't have done that. But equally, we were the first country in the world to legally adopt a net zero target by 2050. The first country in the world as a major industrialised nation.
So, not good enough.
Oh, fair enough. Well,
Sonia, private schools. Hashtag abolish Eton. This is a sort of small group of really enthusiastic campaigners. They come to Labour conference. They get this motion passed. My impression is that what ends up in the manifesto might be rather less radical than that. Is this a good issue for Labour to be pursuing?
Well, I think it's a good issue for Labour to be pursuing on a principle basis, absolutely. And, I'm very supportive. I wrote a column a few weeks ago arguing that Labour should go further on private schools. I think VAT on private schools, for example, is a no-brainer. It's not that radical when you consider that one Michael Gove, a Tory MP, former education secretary, supported it. I've also argued for caps on the number of private school students that universities can take. I think that's a soft way of actually making parents reassess the benefits of private education. I'm not so sure that John McDonnell, Angela Rayner would be as comfortable with the idea of taking the assets of private schools, the government taking them over. I think that was quite a radical part of the motion. I would be shocked if that was in the manifesto. I think if the front bench had had their way, that might have got taken out before it went to the floor of conference. But, I think on principle, it's good territory. The thing I would slightly query, though, is I think it's quite hard to make that land electorally. I think intuitively voters are not that fussed about scrapping private schools. In fact, intuitively, I think a lot of people think, as a parent, it should be up to you. If you've got the money, you should be able to send your kid elsewhere. So I think Labour are going to have to work pretty hard to make that argument on egalitarian grounds, because it's not very intuitive. But that said, I think there is plenty of other stuff in a potential Labour manifesto that would be more popular. So another thing I've argued for years is free care for the over 65s. I've always said that Labour just aren't radical enough on this. There was no excuse for them not to come out and say they were doing it 2 years ago in the 2017 manifesto. And so it's quite a relief to see that they finally got there.
Yeah, it's the retail policies, isn't it? It's those things that will be. So I was talking to a shadow cabinet member who was saying that for those voters who are quite Brexity, perhaps in his constituencies and a Leave constituency, maybe don't dally on the issue of Brexit, but there's a really attractive offer to some of those voters who might be in a low income job, who might be, have other issues that concern them. So the 32-hour week, getting rid of prescription charges. There's a sort of pact manifesto now, isn't there?
I mean, they've got, Labour have got like literally hundreds of amazing policies. But I think, you know, as Ed Miliband's tenure should remind us, who he had, I mean, his policies were a little bit kind of neither hither nor thither in some ways, but you know, in the sense that, for example, he didn't go for all-out rail nationalisation or all-out privatisation, but tried to sort of balance both, and it just ended up not.
Things
really
were different then, Ellie Mae.
Yes, yes. You know, what's it? Lenin said, "There are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen."
Oh, for the former.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not just policies that win an election. You also have to tell a story about the country and about where it's going and where you're going to take it as leader, who your leader is, what the party stands for, what its values are. And I think that Labour still needs to work on that. And I, particularly in terms of, I don't think actually that the public are as obsessed with Brexit as perhaps Westminster is. However, I think that Brexit, the Labour's Brexit position sort of speaks to a wider empty space where there should be a sort of clear vision. And I think that's still being built, but Boris Johnson's vision, which I find utterly repulsive, is nonetheless clear.
Pretty clear, yeah.
And I think the other thing is that, and this is another parallel perhaps to draw with Ed Miliband, Ed Miliband's policies were far more popular than the man himself. And I think you see the same with Jeremy Corbyn. So he was going into the conference with, you know, approval ratings of minus 60, the worst ratings of any leader of the opposition for decades. So that's really tricky for Labour, I think, to come back from. And can, you know, I think it's difficult for Jeremy Corbyn. I think there have been moments in the last kind of couple of months where he's looked very prime ministerial back in early September. The problem is that that just doesn't seem to be cutting through to voters. He's not very popular amongst them, even less so than Boris Johnson.
And Ellie Mae, there was a lot of chat in the sort of bars and restaurants and whatever around Brighton about who comes next, which was kind of odd because we're potentially weeks away from a general election. There was a feeling certainly that this, the Tom Watson thing, was about trying to secure the party for somebody that Jeremy Corbyn might want to anoint. And, you know, there's quite a lot of machinations going on, I would say. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's also fair to be like, wow, Jeremy Corbyn is going to be prime minister, because, I mean, imagine saying that in 2014. You know, it's a sort of astonishing change in politics. I think in terms of a successor, I mean, what I would say this is that, yes, Jeremy Corbyn, I think actually is like in all likelihood is going to be prime minister. I actually didn't think this until I did a fringe at Labour conference with a pollster who said that it was going to be a hung parliament in Labour's favour, and he sort of convinced me. So I think, I mean, yes, there's a very strong possibility. But of course, if that doesn't happen, then there will be calls for Jeremy Corbyn to step down. And it's only right that, you know, the members of the party, the leadership of the party, have a conversation about who will replace him. So I don't, I think amongst the Labour membership, it's sort of unspeakable to talk about a successor because Jeremy is the man. But I think it's just sensible. You know, this is supposed to be about a movement. It's supposed to be about 500,000 people transforming politics in this country. It's not supposed to be about one person. So while I want to be very clear that I don't want Jeremy Corbyn to stand down, if he decides to stand down and anoint a successor, I think it's fine to have a conversation about who that is. And I think we should all be able to have that conversation without it being seen as a threat to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
Sonia, the way that the Brexit debate played out was really interesting, wasn't it? Because the assumption of a lot of the kind of Remain activists within the Labour Party had been all the members of Remain, vast majority of the members of Remain, clearly we're going to win this. Mm. And actually, it turned out that quite a lot of members are more loyal to Jeremy Corbyn than they, you know, they put that above caring about the specific details of their position. Also, perhaps that the left of the party is better at organising who the delegate is and who's in the room. It's all about who's in the room for those for those votes. But, you know, what does that tell you about the party going forward, do you think? I mean, Shadow Cabinet member said to me afterwards, this is Jeremy's party. And, you know, that was sort of the message, wasn't it, from where we ended up on Brexit?
Yeah, I think it was to some extent. It was definitely a close vote and, you know, ideally, the leadership would have not seen that Remain moment motion go to the floor of conference. So I don't think we should sort of forget that. And speaking to MPs who, you know, think that we do need, that Labour does need to campaign for a Remain in a referendum after that vote, their take on it was, well, we didn't even expect to be in a point where that motion was going to the floor and people were getting to talk about it. So I think it's worth bearing that in mind. But I think, yeah, ultimately, it was a very close vote, but the way that the leadership won it was making it an ultimate loyalty test to Corbyn. And by saying, you know, if this Remain motion wins, that's very difficult for us and it's going to be very difficult for Jeremy Corbyn. So, of course, it shows, I think the fact that it was close shows that, you know, there's much more division in the party on this than you might think. But that, of course, he still inspires loyalty from quite a few members.
Was this a good moment to go after Tom Watson?
I think that they should have either, you know, it's what the phrase from The Wire, if you take a shot at the king, you best not miss. Not that he's the king, he's the sort
deputy
of
king.
Deputy king. I mean, the same definitely applies to Jeremy there. But I think if you're going to do it, you should do it. And if you're not going to do it, you should not do it. You should not do it and then change your mind, because then you get the media storm, but with your aims unfulfilled. So you get the bad side and not what you wanted. So I think they should have either done it or not done it. And then we've just been circling around the question of sort of loyalties to the membership. And my take on this really is that the shadow cabinet, including Tom Watson, need to be far more loyal than they are, because that's a part of the job description. That's collective responsibility. But I think that the Labour membership needs to be much less loyal than it is. And remember that the point of being in a movement and being represented by them is not just that you shield them from attacks and make sure they stay in place, but also that you hold them to account. And I think one reason why I was a little bit disappointed by the Brexit motion is not because of the particular policy direction, but because it suggested to me a sort of very strong loyalty to the leadership from some sections of the membership. Sonia's right to suggest it's not a blanket thing. And I would urge members to support Jeremy Corbyn, but also to hold him to account and to remember that he's their representative as well as their leader.
Paul, it's Conservative Party conference starting this weekend. There won't be any of this nonsense, will there? Contentious blokes on the conference floor about what the party's policy should be.
Work. Not on the Tory party.
It doesn't work in quite the same way.
Just
probably,
loads of
thankfully.
Speeches with rapturous applause.
Yeah, exactly. It's not clear how many people will be there either.
That's true.
I don't think. I wonder how members of the Tory party, you know, perhaps on the wing that Nicholas Soames and Ken Clark and those other sort of refugees are on, will feel. I mean, I'm interested to see what the mood is going to be in the party this weekend.
It's a difficult time for all parties, in the same way that sort of Jeremy Corbyn has energised a section of his membership, and obviously that's grown quite a lot. He faces a problem about, can he do the same in the country? And, you know, there are clearly splits, big splits in my party too. You know, it's just a product of where we are at the moment.
Thanks all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Sonia Soda, Ellie Mae O'Hagan, Paul Harrison and David Smith. The producer was Simon Barnard. This is his last episode. We're going to miss you, Simon. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.